creator of all things, both visible and invisible, who revealeth his mysteries out of his treasures to them that call upon him, and fatherly and mercifully bestoweth those his secrets upon us without measure. May he grant unto us, the seekers of his secrets, that we may discuss this book of Arbatel concerning the greatest secrets which are lawful for people to know, and use them without offense unto God. Amen. This is an introduction to the Arbatel, part one of a 9-part series about the 1575 grimoire. So buckle up, let's have fun.
Speak the charm of make, charm of make, charm of make, charm.
There will come a time on the planet Earth when science and technology will be long forgotten. When wizards will rule the world.
This is the Arnomancy Podcast. Join your host, Reverend Eric, and his diverse array of amazing guests in an exploration of tarot, magic, the occult, and the history of Western esotericism. The Arnomancy Podcast exists thanks to the support of generous listeners like you. Please consider supporting this podcast for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/arnomancy. Welcome to the Arnomancy Arbatel Project. This is a podcast series about one of history's most popular and most mysterious grimoires. This is the first episode of a 9-part series. If you would like to listen to all of the other episodes in the series, you can find them at arnomancy.com/arbatel. This series is dedicated to Ophiel, the Olympic spirit of Mercury, who teaches all arts and grants one the skill to instantly turn Mercury into the Philosopher's Stone. My guest co-host in these episodes is Evan Gowan, and I will let him introduce himself.
My name's Evan Gowans. I've worked through it once, but I've read through it a number of times. It's what got me practicing versus just reading. I think I started tackling the Arbatel in 2019, 2020. I mean, it's the same reason I got into Freemasonry. I was interested in these topics. I was interested in the esoteric and occult subjects, and I just wanted to know things. And so I was buying up every book that I could on every topic that I could think of in terms of esotericism, and every grimoire, books on philosophy, books on spirituality, different religions. I had maybe, I guess, a loose chaos magic approach to things. I just kind of did stuff and to see what would happen. I've always been kind of had a healthy dose of skepticism approaching anything.
You probably already know me. I am Reverend Eric, the host of the Arnomancy Podcast, and the human behind the Arnomancy website. You can learn more and find a bunch of additional stuff at arnomancy.com. The Arbatel is a 16th century Swiss grimoire, or book of magic. Unlike other grimoires of the time, it is light on ritual, and instead focused on beneficial magic and good spirits. In fact, this book is probably, possibly, the origin of the 7 Olympic spirits. In this introductory episode, we will introduce the Arbatel by looking at the history of the book. Where did it come from? Who wrote it? How is it published? And why are the circumstances of its publishing important? Now, almost every model of magic can work with scrying, which is a divination practice that involves gazing into reflective surfaces, flames, smoke, or some other medium, to receive visions, to communicate with spirits, or to channel messages. Scrying is an ancient practice, woven deeply into the fabric of human culture throughout history. And the Arbatel is kind of all about this. Now, the scrying practice that most fascinates me is the tradition of spirit evocation, which may have originated around the Mediterranean, particularly in Greek and Roman Egypt, and then seems to have percolated into the grimoire tradition of medieval and Renaissance Europe. Many of the grimoires that we have access to today are solidly Christian, probably from underground or fringe magical traditions, and frequently seem to have been written by the wealthier classes. The techniques outlined in many of these grimoires are filled with seals and signs, magic circles, magical vestments, wands, daggers, lamens, swords. Exotic incenses and ingredients pepper the pages of these mystical manuals, alongside long and intricate rituals, flowery invocations, and even the occasional barbarous name. Gosh, I love a good barbarous name. While we do have some later grimoires from working-class magicians and practitioners that show simpler, more straightforward models of evocation and working with spirits, we also have one earlier example that outlines a remarkably straightforward, simple method of communicating with an entire class of spirits. I'm talking, of course, about the Arbitel. First published in Basel, Switzerland in 1575, the Arbitel is a fairly short book containing seven groups, or septenaries, of seven aphorisms each. Now, each of these septenaries deals with a specific topic for the magician or practitioner, ranging from how to live a righteous life, to how to summon Olympic spirits, to how to conduct magical experiments. Though written from the point of view of Renaissance-era Swiss Protestantism, the spirits listed in the Arbitel are not found in any previous grimoires. They are not your classical angels, archangels, or demons. Instead, they are a group of planetary entities called the Olympic Spirits. Now, this opens up a number of excellent possibilities when working with this grimoire, because it means that the context of the Olympic Spirits and working with them can be lifted out of its Protestant context and made available to magicians and practitioners of other religious and spiritual backgrounds. And we're going to cover that in this series. So, in addition, in this series, we will explore each of the Arbitel's seven septenaries, one per episode. We will look at the magical practices and techniques that can be taken from its pages and used by any practitioner to lead a more fulfilling life, not just magically, but also in the outside world. I really hope that you will join us. Like all grimoires, the Arbitel has plenty of weirdness about it. Let's start with a name. The name is weird. On the title page of the book, it is spelled out in Hebrew. But why? The title ending in L kind of has the structure of an angelic name. You will recall from Agrippa's method for calculating spirit names that the names of spirits always end with L, Yah, or Yod. And come to think of it, Agrippa's method for calculating spirit names generates a five-letter name with a suffix, and Arbitel, spelled out in Hebrew, fits that pattern. So maybe... But no. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We don't really know what the name Arbitel means. However, one theory is that it is a reference to the Tetragrammaton, or four-letter name of deity. Arba is Hebrew for the number four, and El is one of the names of God. Therefore, it's possible that the name Arbitel could be a reference of the Tetragrammaton, literally meaning the four-letter name of God. But is that what it is? We don't know. You will notice as we explore the contents of the Arbitel that there will be themes that are not present in most other grimoires. This book has a really heavy emphasis on direct experience. In addition, piety and service are key practices for the magician. The work of the Arbitel revolves around learning, around keeping secrets, and around working with spirits that reveal themselves specifically and perhaps uniquely to each magician. Some of the experts that we know of, that you can go online and get lots of people's, or maybe not lots, but a number of people's impressions and opinions of the Arbitel.
Right.
And like Josephine McCarthy, for instance, who we were just talking about before we started recording, she seems to think that the Arbitel is not only like a very advanced book, but like a really, really serious one fraught with peril and danger.
Right. Yeah.
Has that been your experience so far?
It hasn't. I mean, if anything, I think that like my experiences have been pretty light compared to mm-hmm. like as far as Like, if you were to compare to some, like, you know, reading through people's experiences through blogs or online with different, various different grimoires, mm-hmm. you know, there's, it almost seems, there's a lot more ritual surrounding it, but the outcome seems a lot, I don't know how else to describe it aside from heavy versus light. Like, this, mm-hmm. like, almost like lighthearted, my experience is, has been positive, and I think, I don't know if maybe it's the way that you approach the book that really determines the outcome or approach the process. Indeed. There wasn't anything that I was really looking for outside of, I just want to understand, you know, is this real, is this not real, what mm-hmm. what, and if I can get into communication with these entities or beings, what do they have to say, really?
And which is something that we will discuss at a future episode. Don't give it to me. No, I won't. So I think later on. So, I mean, one of the interesting things about the Arbitel, like, first of all, as you said, it's very small. Mm-hmm. Compared to other grimoires, it has a spirit catalog of like 7, you right. know? And most of the book, honestly, isn't about them. You
right.
know, there's a lot of other stuff in there. I mean, I'm looking forward to exploring this more with you, because as much as you can spend time with the Arbitel, there are parts of it that are a little dry and difficult to pay a lot of attention to. But if we're doing this one chapter at a time, let's look at some of the history around the time the Arbitel was printed. The 16th century was a time of change in Switzerland. In the early 1500s, the Protestant Reformation had kicked off in Germany, but its influences were felt across Europe. Switzerland got started with its big changes a few years earlier. The aftermath of the Swabian War of 1499 saw the formation of the Swiss Confederacy that was nominally independent of the Holy Roman Empire and has also sometimes been called the first democracy in the Western world, although I'm not sure how true that was. Now, October 31st, or Halloween of 1517, was the kickoff of the Protestant Reformation, when Martin Luther nailed his theses to the wall of that, or to the door of that church. But Protestantism was never really, or the Reformation itself was never really, like, 100% adopted by Northern Europe. And in fact, even by the time of the publishing of the Arbitel, and even today, Switzerland is not 100% Protestant, so it wasn't even then, which caused friction and led to more wars. The Wars of Kappel in 1529 and 1531 were between Catholic and Protestant cantons in the Swiss Confederacy, and the aftermath helped establish Quis Regio Eius Religio, or the ruler determines the religion. This meant that every city, every canton in Switzerland had a religion, was either Protestant, some branch of Protestant, or a Catholic, depending on the religion of the ruler. So the Arbitel was published in Basel. Basel today is kind of seen as the cultural capital of Switzerland. It's located on the Rhine River at the transition from the High Rhine to the Upper Rhine. And even back in the 16th century, it contained the University of Basel. And Basel joined the Swiss Confederacy in 1501, when it was just 2 years old. The Confederacy, not the city. We can't really talk about the Arbitel or its impact without mentioning one very important historical person. And it's super possible that you came to this podcast just to hear me say Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim, otherwise known as Paracelsus. Now, Paracelsus lived from 1493 to 1541. He kind of overlaps with Heinrich Cornelius Agrippa a little bit, but he wasn't always in the same places at the same time. In fact, Paracelsus taught at the University of Basel from 1526 to 1528. Desiderius Erasmus was there at the same time, and Paracelsus and Erasmus got to know each other and actually set up a correspondence and corresponded for a number of years. Another significant person who was present at the University of Basel at this time was the Protestant theologian Huldrych Zwingli. However, he was killed on the battlefield during the Second War of Kappel in 1531, so he's not really going to be part of our story. So let's talk about Paracelsus and his esoteric and spiritual approach, and how that might have influenced some of the cool stuff in the Arbitel. Paracelsus believed that all of creation contained divine signatures, and he kind of ascribed to that hermetic philosophy that saw humans as microcosms of a universal macrocosm. He viewed disease as something that was spiritual as well as physical, which meant that healing required both physical and spiritual treatment. Prayer and faith were essential components of medicine, so he emphasized the physician's spiritual development. However, he also used astrological talismans and timing in his treatments, and practiced sympathetic magic in some of his remedies. Paracelsus wrote about the four elemental spirits, gnomes, sylphs, undines, and salamanders, and he saw imagination as a real force that affected physical reality. Now we're going to talk about two people that I'm just going to mention and go over a little bit, who were probably influential in the writing and publishing of the Arbitel, because Paracelsus was already dead when the Arbitel was published, so he didn't actually write it, but people who were influenced by him certainly did. The first we're going to talk about is Theodor Zwinger. Joseph Peterson thinks that he probably helped edit the Arbitel. He was a physician who was originally hostile to the ideas of Paracelsus, but he eventually changed his mind and became a supporter. If you ever are visiting Basel, or perhaps if you live there right now, you can go walk by his historical home, the Zwinger Haus. Another significant character in our story is Jacques Gori, who lived from 1520 to 1576. Joseph Peterson thinks that he was the author of the Arbitel. He was a French aristocrat. He was a writer, a translator, and an occult philosopher. In fact, he translated Machiavelli's The Prince in 1571 and produced a book called De Vita Longa, which was a commentary on Paracelsus. It's also possible that he was involved in the translation of the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili into French in 1546. So here's something that is interesting about the Arbitel to me. It's coming on the heels of a lot of other grimoires and stuff, and it doesn't have magic circles. It doesn't have piles of sigils. It doesn't have descriptions of the demons and of demons and how they're going to appear. You know, like, you know, a duke riding a black horse with a chihuahua for a head or whatever. Like, none of that stuff shows up in the Arbitel. And there's this thing about how Protestantism, when it started to sort of like take over in Europe, it eliminated the imagination. Mm. It sort of like tried to wipe out all the stuff involved in imagination, like the art of memory got diminished, like all this stuff sort of happened. And so the Arbitel feels Protestant to me because it doesn't emphasize the power of the imagination very much, and it doesn't really talk about images in any significant way, right? Like there's no talismanic imagery sort of involved.
Right.
We do have the sigils for the planetary spirits, but they're really simple, and they were probably created using Ike Bakar. But you studied some other grimoires also. Like, what are some things about the Arbitel that really stood out to you?
It's very black and white, in my opinion. And it's dry. Yeah. It's very dry, almost. Yeah. Like you said, there's not all the fluff involved. I almost don't see that as a negative, but it is very different from other grimoires in that way, mm-hmm. in that it is just like, here's the process, you know, and it hammers, like, throughout the book, it's constantly hammering home the fact that you need to be, approach it in a specific way, approach it positively or with, honoring God, the whole, you know, and the Christian God really is how it's written. And I think when I first started studying it, I read somebody's take that was just to avoid, persecution or something, to have it be shrouded in all this, but that's not really the way that I read. I almost don't think I would agree with, I feel like whoever wrote it, it almost feels like it was somebody's notes that were late, like from scrying or from their own practice, that were later turned into a grimoire. And then there's all these warnings and personal philosophies added in later. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There's kind of there's almost a preachiness to parts of it, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to I mean, I do think that because of how sparse it is on the Jesus stuff, it's easy to rip it out. You know, like I've practiced the Arbitel from a pagan point of view. Like I find that one of the things that I really love about it is it's so stripped down that it's really easy to just sort of adapt. You know, that a lot of other approaches require so many trappings and so many, there's so much gear. Like the Key of Solomon, you have to have like special shoes. They're the weird slippers. You need everything, and everything has to have a mask set over it.
And I just picture like doing stuff from these other grimoires, having all of this special stuff, and then whatever entity that you're, you know, trying to communicate with or evoke or invoke, they're just laughing like, "Oh, look at this guy," you know, or this woman with all
those
clown
shoes. Yeah. Yeah,
it is very, and that's kind of what I, along the lines of what I took it is it that being cut and dry and not having all the fluff. It's just here it is. It's very bare.
Yeah,
you know, and to the point, which I kind of like because there's no guesswork. There's no like, oh, I need to figure all this shit out before I can do this. It's like here's it's the process is there and everything that you need is right there.
Yeah. But it also does have, like, one of the things that I like about the Arbitel, and actually one of the things I like about the Arbitel as a mason, is it has all these things about, like, if you're going to be a successful magician, here's how you need to act when you're in the world. Like, you have to be a good person, you have to do these good things, you have to practice these virtues. And it doesn't just say it once, like, it sort of goes on about it both before and after the septenary with the spirits. So, like, Frater Acker has a whole set of articles that he's published online about his work with the Arbitel.
Right.
And that's pretty interesting to read through. We've got Frater Acker's stuff. We have Josephine McCarthy who warns about some sort of spirit that guards the Arbitel.
Right. And like hidden rich, like there's hidden workings within the workings. Like,
yeah.
Like that if you just work through it at surface level, it's fine. But if you dive deeper than that, you risk basically bringing about your final judgment and your physical death.
Which is crazy. So, and that makes me think, like, I find that a lot of times when you're reading these older texts, you have to just take them at face value. You have to just be like, they're saying what they mean.
Right.
Understanding that sort of like subtext or that sort of like additional context or that sort of like secret layer, you have to know, first of all, who wrote it, what they were doing at the time.
Right.
Why do you think there's that hidden layer in there? But it also makes me think of Pardes. Pardes is this concept of layered reading.
Right. So, yes, I remember this.
Yeah. So you start with like just the surface layer and then you I don't remember all the layers off the top of my head, but you kind of have like these different ways of like breaking down the text to sort of like get to deeper layers of it, which I think sometimes is really intended, but the Arbitel is really plainly written.
It is. And I think that even if you, how do you know that whatever hidden layer you are discovering isn't your own interpretation of a text that, and like you have that, it's a big leap to go from there's to say that the author intended to have these hidden layers within the text. And it's not just you. I mean, we all have our own biases. We read everything with a bias, whether we mean to or not. And if you start saying, oh, hey, look, you know, here's this thing. Here's the, he may actually mean this, or it may actually mean, I mean, we see it with religious texts all the time. You know, countless people have debated for thousands of years about the different meanings behind different texts. And I think that it's almost, I think that you're right in that the best way to go about it is very plainly written, is to approach it plainly. And if you get your own insights from reading it, then those are your insights, though. You can't make a blanket statement to say this is what the author intended, you know?
Yeah. And I feel like the Arbitel kind of even tells us that.
Right.
Like it sort of says, like, you're going to get your own insights and they're yours.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So, yeah. So there's secrets that you get out of the Arbitel that you're not supposed to share with anybody else.
Because they're meant for you. And it's almost using your own intuition and your own, you know, that's where the beauty of any occult work comes from, is you may come to conclusions that nobody else does. And but they're for you because you can, you're coming to those conclusions to apply to your own practice, your own life. You know, they're not necessarily meant to be like, hey, here, you know, this is how it is. This is how it is for me.
Right.
And you know, which I mean, really is to say with any tech, I mean, different interpretations of movies or, you know,
oh, for sure.
Fiction novels or whatever, you know, people have their own, they can kind of see yourself in, you know, in your own circumstances and things.
So I was thinking about like the Pardes thing. I think another thing that like when you're studying Kabbalah, you have the advantage of having like centuries and centuries of Talmudic scholarship. You've got like the entire Torah to work with. You've got all these other things that you can use to kind of like support and analyze the stuff that you're working on. But with the Arbitel, all we have is the Arbitel. And it's what, like, how long is Joseph Peterson's one? And it's like 100 pages or something.
I feel like the introduction is like...
is longer.
It's like half the length of the actual book.
Yeah. So I think that probably maybe the thing to be concerned with there is that it's easy to read more stuff into the Arbitel than is actually there, just because there's not a lot there.
Right.
But I think it's probably... I think when we're doing it, we should be really conscious of that and warn the listener. Like,
oh yeah,
this is our interpretation. This is something that I think, but it doesn't, I don't know that the text, you know.
Right. Because obviously, I mean, to come to the conclusion, like let's take Josephine McCarthy as an example. Cause she's, her take on it and her experience with it when she was trying to come up with coursework for it and her experience, it seemed very significant, but I think, and so that, I mean, it's a fair warning, but it's really the warning that anybody should take with any, you know, grimoire or magical work that they are working with any beings. Everything should be approached with caution and really a full understanding and with clear intent. You know, it's, I mean,
yeah. I think the clear intent is super important with the Arbitel in particular. And honestly, like it does kind of tell you like,
right.
Don't be a liar. Don't falsify, like, you know.
And it brings up, like, it's okay to ask, this Olympic spirit, you can ask for these things and you won't offend God. And if you ask for these things, you know, you might.
Right.
And it's, I don't know. I don't want to diminish her experience, but I don't think that it could be applied as a blanket statement to everybody approaching this work. Cause I have had nothing but positive experiences with it, but, and as far as intent goes, having a clear intent, like my intent was just, I just want to understand and know, like, I want to understand this more and I want to approach this and see what I can learn from it, you know?
Yeah. So it does make vague. There's that other thing in the Arbitel that comes up, I think, both before and after the septenary with the spirits, where it's like, you don't get to work with the Arbitel unless you're born to work with it, right?
Right.
You don't get to be a magician unless you're born a magician. Yeah. It's like, you don't know if you're born a magician unless you do it and it works.
Great. Which I kind of found that hilarious. If you work with it, nothing happens. Sorry.
You're
not a magician.
Get out of here.
Pack up your books.
Yeah, I find that to be really baffling. Like, you know, I taught an Arbitel class, and when I talked about that particular thing, I was like, there's no test in there. There's nothing in there. It's like, you know, if you can answer these, you get those tests online. It's like, if you can answer these 10 questions, you might be autistic. You might have ADHD or whatever. There's nothing in the Arbitel that really does that. It's just like, if it doesn't work.
Yeah,
you're fucked.
Sorry. it's that I found hilarious, and it almost gives an out.
Yeah,
right. This may or may not work. If it doesn't work, that's it's not the book.
Yeah, yeah, that's totally what it's saying. Like, gosh, I guess you're just not meant to use this book. Sucks to be you.
Maybe in another lifetime.
Maybe your neighbor could use this book.
Yeah. it really emphasizes like being pious and a good person, like you mentioned. And that, I think maybe that may be why, I mean, like with Freemasonry, it very goes along with the philosophies of Freemasonry. It kind of goes and kind of went in line for me personally with my personal philosophies, is just being a good person and being, being positive as far as interactions go with everyday, you know, strangers or friends or whoever. Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of, I wouldn't say I'm religious or I belong to any religion, but it didn't really bother me, the fact that it was very Christian bent. I think that the general idea of just being good and approaching things from that standpoint can really be applied to any, doesn't matter what religion you come from. You can, like you said, you can still kind of put in your own, your own deity or your own personal beliefs can kind of, you can kind of move some things around in there to appeal to your own bent, I guess, or your own.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as we're going through this, I will definitely be approaching it from that angle. So I will talk about the parts where I'm like, well, this made me uncomfortable. This just seemed like it was just sort of like a, you know, a whole Jesus party in this chapter or whatever. So yeah, we'll look at those parts, I think, a little bit. I suppose we should also talk about translations and available translations. Like the one I think that both of us are going to be leaning on the most, the one that we have both brought to our meetings when we've talked about this, is Joseph Peterson's translation of the Arab Tell. It's great because it's got facing page Latin and English translation. It's got an amazing introduction. It feels scholarly and well done. And it's got a great index.
It's really very good. Well done, yeah.
The Arab Tell also shows up in the fourth book of Occult Philosophy, so you can get either Peterson or Skinner's edition of that. And I believe that's all the Robert Turner translation from like 1650-ish. And it's fine. It's just, you know, early modern English, so it's not as easy to read and understand for a modern reader, and it can be maybe a little bit more ambiguous, but I like Joseph Peterson a lot.
Yeah, so do I.
It's a good one. I'm going to ask you some personal questions now. Some non-Arab Tell questions.
Let's get personal.
All right. So outside of ceremonial magic, what do you do?
I do a lot of art. Primarily art. I mean, I do a lot of art, and I read.
Now, when you say art, are you talking about, like, you go up in the hills and you paint watercolors of sunsets? Do you flash paint on canvas in a garage? Do you
only naked?
Right. I mean, how else would you do it? tell us about your art. What's your art?
I've been doing tabletop miniatures, like, so small scale mini 28-32 millimeter miniatures.
Do you just paint them?
I sculpt clay sculptures. So I sculpt them all, or I build, I kitbash different, you know, model kits together and paint them. I do clay, large scale clay sculptures, busts and stuff. I'm a welder. So I did, metal art, for a long time. I had a shop, my own shop. And then, through a divorce, I got rid of all my equipment and, sold off everything. So I don't have a shop anymore.
I lost my KitchenAid mixer in a divorce. So I understand what you're saying.
That's the worst, right?
It sucks.
I know. I mean, at least I didn't lose that. I still have my KitchenAid. I just lost my welder and my lathe. I didn't lose it, I guess. I just had nowhere to store it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I can't put it all in an apartment living room. I did a lot of metal sculpture. Sculpture is really my thing. I like sculpting and I like painting, but painting sculptures. Painting on canvas, I don't know. Painting something 2D, I haven't practiced enough, or my brain just doesn't work that way. I did a lot of tattoo flash art for a long time, but that's simpler, I guess, than doing a full-on scenic painting or something.
Oh, yeah.
But metal sculpture was a lot of fun. I did that for a while and had it in had sculptures in a few galleries.
And you've had some miniatures that you've entered into competitions and stuff too.
And I've placed. I don't think I've ever. I haven't ever won like first place in a competition, but I've got second or third. Mm-hmm. I've placed with them, and I've noticed that with entering competitions, I don't really care if I win or not. It's really just the kick in the ass that I need to get back into it again. Yeah. So, cause it gives me a deadline to complete something by. And so it's like, ah, geez, this is like just the motivation that I need to like get back into doing art, like during periods of not doing it. And so I've used the competition as a way to get my ass in gear and get something out there and then submit it.
Do you think it's possible that the Arbitel might inspire some sculptures?
That would be wonderful.
And that's one of the problems with having zero images and stuff, right? Like, there's nothing to sculpt.
I mean, even the sigils and everything in there are just so geometric.
Yeah.
Like, which, you know, and maybe there's something to be said for that.
Well, when we get to that chapter, I'm going to show you how those sigils are made.
Oh.
And cool. You're going to be like, that's it. Okay, do you have any questions for me?
What got you into the Arbitel?
That's a really good question. It was not my first grimoire, and it was not one of the first magical systems that I worked with. It was actually like the Arbitel was something that I had that I'd read and that had just sat on the shelf for probably like a decade or more. But when I started doing drawing spirits into crystals stuff, when I started doing spirits scrying, probably, I don't know, 2016 or so.
Okay.
Maybe a little bit. It must have been later than that. I don't remember what it was. But that was when I kind of started to pay attention to it, because I have plenty of junk and I didn't want to start accumulating all the stuff required to do like, you know, the Lesser Key of Solomon stuff. I didn't have room for a magic circle. I didn't have the budget to get like all the daggers and knives and fancy slippers. And I just didn't have the ability to do all that stuff. And I was like, okay, well, there must be a system that I can use that can be easier. So I started looking at drawing spirits into crystals, and the Arbitel just worked with that. Like it does fit in. I mean, I started with, of course, Rufus Opus's book, Seven Spheres.
Yes.
So I started with Seven Spheres. And the problem, and I had luck with that, and then I switched over to working with Arbitel stuff when I worked my way through the Seven Spheres material. And I think, so that's kind of when I really got into it. So it wasn't the first time that I'd worked with spirits. It wasn't the first spirit work that I'd done, but it was the one where I looked at it and I was like, this seems better, you know? So that's really how I got into it. It was after many years of ceremonial magic before I did it. But also, I went through many years of ceremonial magic without doing any sort of direct spirit work.
Right. Know? Seven Spheres is, that's an initiatory book, right? Self-initiation?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sort of calls itself that. I don't know.
It's been a long time since I've read
it. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've read it, too. I'm totally still looking. My shelf full of occult books is right behind Evan's head. So I'm looking at it being like, I know Seven Spheres is up there.
Right where my head is at is
yeah. Where it's at. I don't know. Who knows where it is? But yeah, so that's how I approached it. But again, also like for me as a non-Christian, finding Renaissance works that I could work with that could be de-Christianized in order for me to feel comfortable with them is kind of tricky.
It is.
Like there's a lot of them that are just super Catholic, you know, just like you can't get the Jesus out of them.
Yeah, I liked that about Arbitel too, is the fact that it, which is funny because of how Jesus-y it is, but it's so easy to just switch some stuff around.
Yeah, and a lot of times most of the Jesus-y stuff is just like, go be good.
Yeah.
Like don't be a dick.
Yeah. And it obviously, I mean, it had an impact because we're here talking about it, and we've talked about Arbitel quite a bit, like over the time that we've been hanging out with each other and everything, it comes up a lot, and so it had an impact for you.
Oh yeah, it definitely had. Had an impact for me. Like I have kept coming back to it over and over again. Okay. What's the part of the Arbitel that you are the least interested in getting into?
That's a tough question. I don't know. That would be one I'd have to think on that because
there's not very much of it.
There's not very much of it. And I don't know. I feel like it's I mean, it jumps around between the different sections. It's because the spirit work with the Olympic spirits is such is really a small
it
part
is,
of
the
bigger whole. But I don't really know. I feel like it's been really from start to finish for me. It's been pretty well rounded. I'd be hard pressed to find things about it or sections about it that I don't really that were just like meh, don't care. You know.
I think for me, it's the part about you have to be born to be a magician.
Like,
we've talked about it,
right?
And I'm kind of like, I don't know what else to say about it. Like, it feels like a cop out to me. Like, who cares?
Right. It's kind of like look down their nose, like look down your nose type of thing.
It is.
Yeah, I kind of find, you know, there's probably quite a bit of things like that in here that I'm just like, man, that's stupid. But I probably glossed over them and just jumped to the next things.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting going through this a piece at a time and finding those bits for sure.
Yeah, I think we should. I want to approach this again at the end because then I can I'll be like, yeah, that was so dumb.
This section is stupid as fuck. I'll make a note of that. Well, that'll be in our conclusion. We'll talk about that a little bit.
But,
all right. Anything else you want to ask me about this before we?
How has Arbitel become part of I think that anyone that's been into ceremonial magic or magic in general for long enough has their kind of core texts that they always go back to. Has it kind of made its way into your core group of texts, or
I think it's become part of the core group of texts that I read over and over again and use as sort of like guidance over and over again in terms of like figuring out next steps and things like that. But I'm not sure that working with the Olympic spirits has turned into a really core part of my practice. But a lot of the other parts of the Arbitel where it talks about like how to conduct yourself and how to be and all those sorts of things, or even the parts where it talks about like ways of working with spirits or even ways of working with secrets, those have become things that I come back to it over and over again for sure.
Okay.
Which I think has been kind of interesting for me. Like the Olympic spirits are almost, to me, they almost feel like they aren't the core point of the Arbitel sometimes.
Right. I agree with that.
And I think it'll be interesting to kind of explore that a little bit as we go through it. Just to see, I'm really looking forward to seeing how this process changes my relationship with the Arbitel.
Right. Yeah, I'm there with you on that because it's been a while. I mean, I haven't. We moved into got a townhome a year ago and with house projects and all this stuff. Like all of my spiritual practices have kind of fallen by the wayside, especially with settling into a new place. And I very much need to have spaces set aside for specific things. Like I need an art space. I need a space for ritual work. If I don't have those spaces, it's hard for me to get into doing a thing.
Right.
I feel weird doing it in the middle of a living room when I normally have a room, you know? And, and so we haven't fully settled in yet. It's taken a while to get settled into this new place. And so that's what really excited me when we started talking about this a few weeks ago, is I'm hoping that this also, as we work through this, I kind of get back into studying it more too.
You know, it's spring, the middle of spring right now, early spring, I guess. It's kind of, we're getting into a time when like outdoor ritual is possible.
True.
Maybe one of the things that we can work on as we're going through this is the portable Arbitel kit. So you could like, you know, go out camping, do some Arbitel in the woods.
Right.
Yeah. That would be kind of cool.
That'd be cool.
All right. Well, this has been a really good intro. Thank you, Evan.
Thank you.
Thanks for investing your time in this episode, and thanks for listening to my conversation with Evan. In this episode, Evan and I introduced the Arbitel, a 16th century grimoire and the subject of this podcast series. We explored its historical context and shared our first impressions of the book. In our next episode, Evan and I will dive into the first septenary of the Arbitel. Each septenary, you will notice, is a collection of 7 aphorisms, loosely collected into themes. The first septenary helps set the stage for the book, emphasizing the importance of secrecy in keeping secrets. Now, this series of episodes about the Arbitel is ongoing. There's going to be 9 of them altogether. My Patreon supporters will be receiving each episode a week before the rest of the world, along with bonus materials such as behind-the-scenes clips, a glimpse at works in progress, and the opportunity to suggest further topics for our Arbitel exploration. If you are enjoying these episodes and want to help support their development and production, the best way you can help out is by sharing this podcast with a friend. Let your weird wizard buddies and witch pals know that we have embarked on this journey and that they are invited to join us. And also, if you want to contribute monetarily, you can go to arnomancy.com/support and find a number of options for doing so. Also remember, if you would like to access a playlist of all the Arbitel episodes, you can find one at arnomancy.com/arbitel. Until next time, Evan and I urge you to keep reading books, keep being weird, and keep doing magic. This has been another episode of the Arnomancy Podcast. Thank you for joining me. I have been your host, Reverend Eric. You can find Arnomancy online at arnomancy.com, and you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere podcasts are found. If you like what you hear, please consider supporting the Arnomancy Project for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/arnomancy.
Vanessa Urena, and I'm really excited to announce my new store, Sword and Scythe, where I'll be offering magical art, materia, and services beneath Mars and Saturn. You can visit the store at swordandscythe.com and be sure to sign up for the email list to receive early access to new releases.